Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is On Point. We all know how the private shame of famous women exploded into the public eye with the Me Too movement, but thousands upon thousands of women, mostly immigrants, in low-wage jobs, have their own stories to tell. For them, silent suffering is too often all in a day's work, while they clean offices, pick farm produce, or take care of other people's children. This hour, On Point, the Me Too movement for low-wage workers. You can join us on air or online. Is this your story? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Bernice Young. She's an investigative reporter with Reveal, a public radio show and podcast from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. She's out this week with a new book called In a Day's Work, The Fight to End Sexual Violence Against America's Most Vulnerable Workers. And you can find an excerpt at our website on onpointradio.org. Bernice, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Kim.
So tell us about your work, looking at these workers in marginalized industries and the abuse that they can face.
Well, I've been working since 2012 with a fabulous team of reporters at UC Berkeley and a public radio station here, KQED, looking deeply at how sexual harassment, actually very extreme sexual harassment, has played out in fields such as farm work and the night shift janitorial industries. And what we found is, you know, these are deeply held and open secrets within these industries, that sexual harassment, sexual assault, and even rape is kind of a expected, anticipated workplace hazard in many respects.
And I want to, before we get too deep into this conversation, I want to let our listeners know that we're talking about some very difficult subject matter here, and it may not be suitable for young ears. So I want to play a bit from a 2015 PBS Frontline documentary entitled Rape on the Night Shift. Maria Bohorquez, a janitor in San Francisco's iconic Ferry Building, recounted on how a supervisor grabbed her and forced her down, and then her mind went blank. Let's take a listen.
Siempre me tenía que reportar al supervisor. Empezó como...
At first, he tried to gain my trust. He started with flattery. And then he would pretend to be reaching for something, but would brush against my breasts or sometimes just grab them. I told him that I was going to complain, and he would say, "They won't believe you."
That voiceover was provided by WBUR's Maria Garcia. Bernice, talk about the structural challenges that are in place that keep women like this from being able to come forward, discouraging them from speaking out.
Right. So there are so many parallels to the women's that we've been hearing from in Hollywood politics and the news media, you know, issues such as really internalizing shame for this having happened to them, you know, just deep feelings of and concern around not being believed when they bring forth these types of complaints and concerns. But I think this group of worker also faces very specific barriers to speaking out about this particular problem. For instance, they might have tenuous immigration status. The supervisors and coworkers who are essentially exploiting them you know, might threaten them with deportation or threaten to deport their family members. Mm. The other very serious concern is, you know, the job. Like we've heard from so many women in Hollywood and elsewhere, you know, being blackballed and losing your job is of utmost concern for so many of these women who are working paycheck to paycheck, hand to mouth, often supporting not only families here in the United States, but maybe family members back in the home country. And so there's just so much weight riding on their shoulders. And the idea of quitting a job is just not something they can really contemplate.
So I want to talk a little bit about how this broader Me Too movement that we've seen in Hollywood and in Washington, how that's impacting the stories of these women. First, let me play a clip from Oprah Winfrey after winning the Lifetime Achievement Awards at the Golden Globes in January. She spoke out not just for the famous women, but also the most vulnerable people who face sexual abuse.
So I want tonight to express gratitude to all the women who have endured years of abuse and assault because they, like my mother, had children to feed and bills to pay and dreams to pursue. They're the women whose names we'll never know. They are domestic workers and farm workers.
And Winfrey's list went on. She spoke of factory and restaurant workers, teachers, engineers, doctors, scientists, and women involved in the tech field. Bernice, how has this impacted women when it comes to those who are in low-paying jobs? They don't have the platform that celebrities do, but has this sort of trickled down to them, too?
Well, I can say honestly that when Me Too kind of first went viral and, you know, became something that was on everybody's, you know, television, radio and, you know, social media, I talked to some of the janitors and some of the farmers that, you know, I'd covered in the past, and they were feeling a little bit hesitant. I mean, they were so proud and excited in many ways that women were really shattering the taboo around this topic in this unprecedented way, in such a public way, and it was garnering such powerful attention. But I think there was also this feeling that they had been trying to surface this problem for generations and had not really been heard in the same way. I think that as time has shifted, you know, and the Me Too and Time's Up Now movements have really, you know, taken a very inclusive stance on this issue. I think we're starting to see some great inroads in trying to incorporate all voices into this conversation, which is powerful. But I think there's so much work that has been going on, that is going on now, working on behalf of low-wage immigrant workers to combat sexual violence on the job. You know, again, a known workplace hazard for many years and generations, that I'm hopeful that they will... that these two groups will start to have conversations with each other and start to learn from each other. You know, I did speak to a farm worker at one point who did say something very powerful to me, which was when all of this news broke, you know, and she was seeing these glamorous Hollywood actresses talking about the sexual abuse that they had faced at work. Her reaction was, "Oh my gosh, it's amazing to know that it's not just us."
Hmm. So Lynn is calling from Stamford, Maine. Hi, Lynn. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
Go ahead, Lynn.
Well, I'm a volunteer. I'm not going to say where, but I recently lost my volunteer position because I complained about my coworker grabbing me by the hips and doing something very wrong at work. And I'm a volunteer.
Lynn, what was said to you when you were let go? Did they reference this incident? And what happened when you complained?
Well, my boss called me back and said that I could be a substitute.
And this is the person who assaulted
you? His position. Yes.
So, Bernice, talk a little bit about the story that Lynn is telling. So often the people, the person that a worker would have to report this abused to is either the abuser himself or someone who is closely allied with that person.
That's right. And Lynn, thank you so much for calling in and sharing that. I know these are really difficult, topics and stories to share publicly. I think, unfortunately, what we hear from Lynn is not uncommon based on the reporting that I've been doing, over the past 5-6 years that, first of all, it's difficult to make a complaint often because the person that you're complaining to might be the person who's the aggressor or the problematic supervisor or coworker or someone in a position of power. From the position, from the perspective of the immigrant workers that I've been looking at, sometimes the supervisor who's doing the harassing might be the primary source of communication between the company and the workers because their language abilities are the strongest. And so, again, maybe a lot is conveniently getting lost in translation. And I think, it's been fascinating to, again, watch the Me Too movement and see really for the first time that I can really recall women being believed and then also seeing such rapid and swift and meaningful response. Unfortunately, for many of the, women that we've covered, that just simply hasn't always been the case. They really feel that their employers look the other way, that their supervisors were dismissive, that they just simply were not believed. Mm-hmm. And, I'm doing some reporting now with women workers in all industries. And again, that is a very common refrain that they just were not heard. In fact, when they surfaced a complaint, it only was not addressed. It was them who suffered consequences. And again, this is the kind of messaging that you start to get, which makes it very difficult to say me too. You start to get these messages that when you actually report, there will be consequences against you. And so maybe it's just best to keep quiet, which is exactly what we're trying to get beyond in this moment.
All right, we're talking about working women in low-wage jobs, about their struggles to bring home a paycheck while dodging ropes and threats and even physical attacks by coworkers. When we come back, we will hear from one such working woman. She'll tell us about how she fought back.
I'm Kimberly Atkins.
This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. I'm talking with investigative reporter Bernice Young about her new book, In a Day's Work, The Fight to End Sexual Violence Against America's Most Vulnerable Workers. Could this be going on in your workplace, right under your nose, without you even knowing it? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's bring in two more voices right now, women Bernice came to know in the course of her reporting. Joining us from San Antonio, Texas, is Lilia Garcia, Executive Director of the Maintenance Corporation Trust Fund. Lilia, welcome.
Hi, Kim.
And joining us from Bakersfield, California, is Erica Morales, a former night shift janitor who endured sexual harassment. Erica, thanks for taking the time today.
Hi, Kim.
So, Lilia, tell us a little bit more about what's available. What resources do workers who face themselves, find themselves facing this kind of abuse have, or is that part of the problem? Is it not very apparent?
That is absolutely part of the problem. The resources available are generally legal resources to challenge your employer in court through the legal system that we know often errs and is not compassionate or supportive to deal with the emotional and psychological trauma that these women have faced. So part of the solution that has we've brought to California is the Janitors Union has moved legislative reform that has it made it very clear to the industry that they are bringing this issue to the forefront, and they are forcing the industry to create an environment where employers will be held responsible. Your caller that called in with her situation on as a volunteer, as Bernice said, that is rampant and happens throughout the industry. But for so many of these janitors, it means their job, and they are already earning poverty wages. So they have to make that choice between supporting their family or defending their right to have a safe workplace.
And I want to remind our listeners that we're talking about some difficult subject matter here. It may not be suitable for young ears. I want to pause for a moment to play a clip. It doesn't involve janitorial workers, but it involves farm workers from PBS's Frontline 2013 documentary, Rape in the Fields. We are here listening to Mary Cruz Ladino, who was one of the first to agree to come on camera. She explained why she had been afraid to talk about being raped by her supervisor.
Cierto día fuimos a hacer una inspección en cierto campo.
One day, we went to check the crops in a field. He took the opportunity to abuse me. It happened in a place far from other people. If I said anything, I would lose my job. I couldn't lose my job because I was the one taking care of my daughters. It's very difficult to decide what to say. What do I, how do I react?
And that voiceover was provided by On Point producer Anna Bauman. I want to turn to Erica Morales. Erica, you worked doing janitorial services, but you were facing your own torment by a supervisor. Please share some of your story with our listeners.
Correct. In 2005, I was working as a janitor, a night shift, and particularly it was in bank. You know, the banks are lots of cameras, but it was one place that is not cameras at all. And that particular supervisor, that he always following me through the windows and look at me, and sometimes he just appeared like a ghost. And when I asked him, what are you doing here? And he said, I just want to look at you. I was like, why? I was like, just because I wanna see you. And I was feeling, you know, it was fear all every night while I was working. It was not only me, but one night he tried to rape me, and he's a big guy and tall.
And what did you do? How were you able to get away from him?
I don't know how. I don't know. I just, you know, fought with all my strength, and I was thinking of my daughter. I was thinking of my family. And he tried to do things to me, and I was screaming, but nobody can hear me. I was trying to get out of that room so the cameras can see what he was doing. And he was only laughing at me. And he was telling me that nobody's going to believe me. And it was true. Nobody believes you when everything, you know, when something like that happened to us. They always said that we were the ones that provoked that kind of, you know, things. And I was hearing earlier that we can talk because we can lose our job. We are the only ones that... the base of the, you know, our house is and our kids and everything, and that's one thing that you know, we can stop us to speak up.
Well, Erica, you did speak up. Tell us how you got the courage to do that, and what happened next.
When I leave, that was the last time I can. It was a lot of different times and different places that he always go and try to do things and try to touch me and telling me things. And that particular day was, I said, that's enough. I cannot, you know, having this anymore. And I went to the office and I told the other supervisor that it was happened to be his brother. And he knows everything that he was doing, and he was doing the same thing. And I said, you know what, that's it. This is your case, and please be careful because somebody is going to speak up and going to tell everybody everything that you guys have been doing. And I didn't know it was going to be me. Mm. And when I started talking to other coworkers, and they were telling me their stories, and they said, oh, it happens to me too. It happens to me too. And nobody was saying anything. I was like, I need to do something. I need to do something for me, for this woman, for my mom, for my daughter, and for the other women that are coming to work here. They don't need to pass through this hell.
Yeah, and you did speak up, and that led to part of a lawsuit against ABM Industries and ABM Janitorial Services, where 21 janitorial workers led to a settlement of $5.8 million. Lilia, is this becoming more common? I mean, or is it still that there are more obstacles keeping these women quiet? The Department of Justice estimates some 50 women a day are sexually assaulted on the job, but they say that that's probably underreported.
Unfortunately, there are too many women who do not understand what their rights are and who don't have any support to come forward and to identify their employer. So unfortunately, this is rampant and continues to happen. The work is far from over, and we have to get to very basic issues of women understanding that they have a right to be free of this type of violence at their workplace. But then that introduces the complex issue of poverty and the fact that they're having to choose between supporting their family and defending themselves. And then that is also connected to the complex issue of immigration. And we know so many women are vulnerable in these workplaces because these employers are predatory and use their vulnerability to keep them silent. And let me also add that Erika's leadership and her incredible strength to go through that litigation in part was possible because she knew where her employer was. And in the non-union sector, which is the dominant side of the industry, we don't know. So many of these employers are underground. They don't have offices. They operate out of the trunk of their car. So they essentially, you can never catch them. You could only bring a lawsuit or a criminal complaint when you could identify your defendant. And so that is an overwhelming obstacle.
Well, Lilia Garcia, Executive Director of the Maintenance Corporation Trust Fund, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Erica Morales, a former night shift janitor, joining us from Bakersfield, California. Erica, thank you so much for joining us and telling us your story about how you overcame a terrible obstacle to help so many others.
Thank you. My pleasure.
All right, we're joined on the line by Joanna, who's calling from Raleigh. Hi, Joanna.
Hi, Kim. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to mention I'm an immigration attorney, and women or men who have experienced workplace-based sexual violence who are immigrants who are either undocumented or concerned about losing their employment-based immigration status, they may be eligible for either the T or the U visa. The U is for victims of various types of crimes, including rape and sexual assault, and the T is specific to various types of workplace crimes and workplace exploitation. And both of those can eventually lead to permanent lawful status in the United States. In addition to private attorneys, there are many nonprofits around the country that can help immigrants apply for these at little or no cost, such as many legal aid offices.
So, Joanna, how do folks find these nonprofits? Is there a website they can go that can lead them to places in their own communities?
Unfortunately, there's not one central website that applies to the entire country. I think that people might have to ask around from others in their community. I work primarily with the Hispanic and Latino community in North Carolina, and people tend to be able to tell each other which organizations they should go check out, which attorneys they should talk to, and hopefully they will be able to direct each other to an attorney who can consult with them and see if they might be eligible for this type of a visa.
Mike is on the line from Franklin, Tennessee. Hi, Mike.
How are you doing, Kim? I appreciate you taking my call. I just have a few things to say. I feel really, really sorry for these, and I say these because you have put this into a category where you're talking about underprivileged people. But I, when I say these, I'm talking about all the women. As a man, I am sorry for this happening. I lived in a second country. I lived in Spain for 6 years. I learned that I had to learn to speak English or speak Spanish. These people that come, I believe that at some point in time, as a woman, as a young girl, if a man touched them, if they turned around and slapped him in the head and kept doing it right then, you know that it's not the first time he's done this. Bring it to people's attention. As this woman said, they got $5 million because they took the company to court. All of the women were being accosted by the same predatory dude. And those are the kind of, where are their fathers? Where are their brothers? I don't understand why everybody is, it's, oh, I can't make it. I can't make it. Yes, you can. You use a stick. You do something. And every time I hear about this, when finally somebody,
Well, Mike, I just want to say, what about the folks who are afraid of losing their jobs?
Oh, but they don't lose their jobs because it's not his first time. They don't lose their jobs. If they raise enough cane, they do not lose their jobs.
All right, Mike, thank you so much for joining us today. Labor activist Greg Osbed came to Immokalee, Florida in 1993 to work on tomato farms. He went on to co-found the Coalition of Immokalee Workers to fight for workers' rights. In a 2015 interview with CBS News, he described what he saw in the field.
There were wage theft, sexual harassment, violence. I mean, you would come out here on Friday in the evening for payday. You know, people would get their checks right outside the office. And it was not uncommon to see somebody get beaten up by a boss. And their crime would usually be because they felt they got underpaid.
Bernice, how common are stories like the one we just heard?
I think one of the biggest challenges with this issue is that it's so deeply underreported that I can't give you a number. I can tell you that in our reporting, when we went from Florida to Minnesota to Iowa to Washington to California, everywhere we went looking at these issues, we found cases. And in talking to people and workers about those cases, we learned of other people who had similar concerns and complaints. So I think, you know, the scope is real and widespread. You know, putting a statistic to it is difficult. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, the farm workers that Greg is talking about, you know, I think working in isolation in a rural area where there's not a lot of legal aid, where there are not a lot of social service resources at the same scale as in urban centers, you know, makes the issue harder to surface.
So there has been some change within the industry. For example, some fast food companies have begun refusing to buy produce unless the companies, these produce companies, have implemented policies to root out this type of behavior. Talk about the action that has been taken by some companies.
So some companies have joined the Fair Food Program, which the Coalition of Immokalee Workers spearheaded. And it's a really interesting model because it's also a market-based model. So, you know, they get organizations like Whole Foods and McDonald's to join the program. And in joining that program, they agree to only buy produce from fair food farms. And these are farms now in various parts of the country, many of them in Florida, who have agreed to abide by a very strict code of conduct and also agree to participate in a very kind of holistic and multi-prong or kind of system where, speaking specifically about sexual harassment, there's a zero tolerance for it. And, you know, I think many companies probably have zero tolerance for sexual harassment. But what's really interesting and important about the Fair Food Program is that they also have unannounced audits, and they also have multiple ways for workers to complain about sexual harassment. So if you're uncomfortable going to your supervisor, because in fact that's the person who's harassing you, you can go and make use of the confidential free phone hotline. They also do regular trainings around issues like sexual harassment and other workplace rights. And so that's another space that's opened up for, you know, getting in contact with somebody who can help them with a concern or a claim.
This is On Point. I'm Kimberly Atkins. I'm talking with Bernice Young, an investigative reporter with the radio show and podcast Reveal, and author of In a Day's Work, The Fight to End Sexual Violence Against America's Most Vulnerable Workers. You can find an excerpt of her book on our website, onpointradio.org. And you can join the conversation. Are we on the cusp of real change? Can we actually, if we only pay attention, make life better for the low-wage women workers in our communities? How can we do that? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Now, Bernice, I want to talk about why companies are sometimes, often, slow to change, slow to address these issues. Is it a matter of profit? I mean, sort of addressing this, raising wages, putting in place programs that make it easier to report this conduct, that can be expensive, right?
Right. I think there's probably many reasons that it's a difficult issue to deal with. What we've heard from employers and, you know, those representing employers is that, you know, these are he said, she said cases, you know, that classic he said, she said situation. So who do you believe? And arguably, in too many cases, you know, he is getting one side is getting more weight than the other. And it's true that these are very difficult cases to investigate. But on the other hand, in speaking to workplace investigators, there is a way to really gauge what's happening by talking to a wide swath of coworkers and other people who might be able to observe or have observed problematic behavior by the accused individual, other people who might have experienced something similar. It's challenging, but not impossible. I think that, you know, what seems to happen is that you've got somebody who's proven, a supervisor who is doing a really good job at their job, and you might have somebody in a role that you might not value as much, unfortunately. And so when, the complaint is made, there just tends to be that power imbalance playing out yet again.
Indira is calling from Miami. Hi, Indira.
Hi, Kim.
Go ahead. You're on.
I was wondering about what you think can be done for the mindset of all the women.
Indira, we're losing you a little bit. Can you speak clearly into the phone?
Sorry. I was wondering what could be done about the mindset of the co-worker women who can support them, because this is not a one-time thing when it happens.
Yeah, we're losing Indira a little bit, but she's talking about the systems that are in place for lower wage workers to unite, to have that strength in numbers that we saw in the case of Erica. Go ahead, Bernice.
So I think there have been a lot of really interesting efforts in recent years, especially by workers themselves, worker centers, worker advocates, unions, to really tackle this issue. Among hotel workers, for instance, there have been some local ordinances to provide panic buttons to workers in hotels if they're experiencing some type of harassment or even worse. The farm workers with the Fair Food Program, I think that's just a very powerful model of how not only growers but also coworkers can be held accountable to make sure that it's a sexual harassment-free workplace. Among the night shift janitors, Lilia Garcia and others have been really at the forefront in California with new legislation and new efforts to really empower a lot of the workers through training. And I know training, you know, sounds like so ho-hum. Everybody does sexual harassment training and they watch some really kind of, frankly, perfunctory, maybe even boring sexual harassment training video. But I think what is happening now, the efforts to train night shift janitors and also farm workers is really fascinating because they're making videos for and by the workers themselves to really pull in the experience, the lived experiences of women workers so that they can relate to actually what is being described. They're actually learning what sexual harassment looks like in the context of their industry and their job. Mm. And they're being shown exactly how to respond and what their rights are. But I think the other really critical piece of it that janitors in California have been doing is that they've been creating this kind of each one teach one model, the Promotora program, where a small group of janitors are being taught how to deal with sexual harassment, what it is, but then also how to do outreach. And so, you know, it's coming from somebody that they can relate to, somebody who speaks their language, who also understands their experience and can also be kind of a guide through what can be a very challenging process.
So I want to raise the issue of perhaps do we need to address the way these workers are themselves seen in society? One of our listeners has a comment on our website, which starts out by saying no sexual harassment should be tolerable. But specifically, we need to change the way we perceive low-wage jobs in general. These people are not expendable. They are the backbone of our system. They often do the dirtiest, most stressful jobs that most people don't want to do, probably because everyone understands these jobs are so abusive. And they deserve clean, safe work environments that pay a living wage. Bernice, how much does this have to do with how we see low-wage workers?
I think it's a really critical point. I think part of what makes this group of workers particularly vulnerable to something like extreme sexual harassment on the job is, A, the isolation that we've been talking about. I mean, which Erica talked about so eloquently, you know, finding yourself in a situation where there are no cameras. And so you're isolated, but she was also being invisibilized. you know, she was hidden literally from the eyes of the bank patrons. Mm-hmm. She was made to work at night so that no one would have to see her or her labor. And so I think that, yeah, I think that's a really critical element of it. Why do we have to not associate and see and humanize the person who's doing this really important work so that our businesses and our office buildings function in the way that we expect them to? I mean, one very telling story was we were out working on the documentary Rape on the Night Shift, and we were at a mall tracking one of the janitors as she was cleaning very early one morning. And then, you know, as the morning wore on, some of the workers came in to start to set up the store for the public, and they were selling makeup and watches and so on. And they saw the TV cameras, and they wanted to know if we were there to do a fashion event. Mm. And we said, no, we're here to do a documentary about the janitor. And we pointed to her. She was about 25 feet away cleaning a window, a mirror. And they said, who? And they had never, in all their years working there, noticed that Leticia was there every morning cleaning the mirror. So I think part of, you know, people want to know, what can we do? What can I do? And I think part of it is just humanizing and seeing the workers around us and paying attention to the fact that they are there and that, you know, they might be experiencing some difficulties. And you know, when we have an ability to engage with, say, a grocery store or our office building, can we also extend our expectation for safety in the workplace to everybody in that space?
Okay. Rudy is calling from Morristown, Tennessee. Rudy, thanks for joining On Point.
Hi, Kim. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question and then a hopefully very brief comment to make. My question is, while doing this, did you encounter many men who have experienced this? I'm a rape survivor, and about a year and a half ago, it was actually a year ago around this time, I started talking about what happened to me. I never reported it. And when the Me Too movement came around and I was talking about it, so many women told me that I should not talk about what happened to me because it takes away from what happened to them because I'm a man. And we don't really know the statistics on how often this happens to men because men don't come forward. It took me 13 years. And I have also experienced sexual harassment in the workplace by both men and women. I'm in the food industry as part of my income. And in my younger days, I just went back into it a few weeks ago, but in my younger days, that's what I did primarily, and it came from customers, it came from fellow coworkers, and from management, and I just wish that people would understand that this is not a man-woman issue. This is a victim of issue.
And Rudy, did you feel safe to report those instances, or did you keep that to yourself?
I kept it to myself. You just kind of have to laugh it off and just go about because, okay, a big question I get from people is, how does this happen to a man?
Well, Bernice, how about that? What about Rudy's experience? Is that something you hear?
Yes. And Rudy, again, thank you for sharing. It is difficult. And I think, you know, when we were doing the reporting, we were very conscious, and in the book, too, I was very conscious about focusing in on the experiences of low-wage immigrant women because I wanted to have focus. But certainly, we have come across cases of extreme sexual harassment against men in the workplace. There were a handful of cases, especially in farm work, that were notable. And I think at the crux of all of this, and I do agree, there's so many taboos for men to talk about this as well. But at the crux of all of this is an exploitation of power. You know, it has nothing to do with whether it's a man or a woman. And some of this is not even about the sex of it. It is about somebody in a position of power deciding that they are going to exploit and really violate somebody else's person because they are being exploitative and they are unscrupulous. And so, again, gender, sex has nothing to do with it. And I think that those who are experiencing sexual harassment and worse as men, you know, I'm sure that it is far more prevalent than we can possibly understand. And I think it's been interesting to see people like Terry Crews begin to step forward and mm-hmm. create a space for men to talk about it.
Yeah. Bernice, can you talk about other obstacles that some of these workers face, not just from their own supervisors or the company, but maybe from their own households or their family members who may be against bringing this sort of attention to themselves? Are there cultural issues?
I think that so much of what makes it difficult to come forward is, you know, so many of the women are thinking about everybody else but themselves. You know, they're thinking about how this will reflect on their husbands, their partners, their other family members. Will it make them embarrassed or shamed? And it's definitely part of the calculation for many of the workers that we spoke to. There were some women that we spoke to who, even as they had pursued some kind of legal recourse, did not necessarily tell their male partners what was going on because they were concerned that, again, they might make them ashamed or upset. Mm-hmm. There's also concerns that you can imagine if you are the husband or partner of someone who's experienced this, one of your reactions might be anger, and anger at the person who did this to your loved one. And so a lot of the workers we spoke to were also thinking about, again, everybody else but themselves, thinking about how this would affect their partner, their feelings, and they didn't want their partner to do something out of anger.
Sure.
So, yes, there was a lot there that, you know, in terms of the family members that often, again, contributed to the silence.
Agnes is calling from New London, Connecticut. Hi, Agnes.
Hi, Kate.
Go ahead, Agnes.
Okay. My question was, I was employed at one of the hospitals here in Connecticut for almost 25 years. We were always short staff, and at one point, I asked the supervisor to help me.
All right. Agnes's line is, we have a bad connection, but the gist is that she was harassed by a supervisor. She's a nurse of 25 years, and it only got worse when she complained. She ultimately had to leave. Speak a little bit about that. I mean, even just coming forward and speaking sometimes isn't enough.
That's right. You know, coming forward can often result in retaliation. You know, the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, they're the federal commission that polices sexual harassment. And they have found that a good number of their sexual harassment cases, the majority of them, also come with retaliation claims. So, you know, the second you say something, well, you know, your hours are cut. Or maybe they have to lay you off. And so, you know, again, workers are getting the message that if they say something, there will be repercussions, you know, that coming forward is not a guarantee to swift justice all of the time.
And just moving forward in the little bit of time that we have, what do we have to be hopeful about? Is there really a demonstrated increased focus on these lower wage workers and the plight that they face?
I think that what has kept me very hopeful in the many years of covering this issue are the women themselves and also the work that they have been doing amongst themselves to really problem solve around all of this. On first of all, just the level in which they have been resilient and responded in such powerfully positive ways to some very difficult and horrible things is quite inspirational. And I think now many of them, like Erica and others, are, you know, they're going out and they're trying to help other women. They are fighting for legislation, local legislation, state legislation. They're, you know, doing a lot of outreach to help anybody that they can to make sure that sexual harassment and sexual violence isn't part of the job.
All right, Bernice Young is an investigative reporter with the radio show and podcast Reveal, and author of In a Day's Work, The Fight to End Sexual Violence Against America's Most Vulnerable Workers. Bernice, thank you so much for reporting on this.
Thank you so much, Kim.
And you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast on our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is On Point.